So you see, if we conceive, if we change in our own thinking the idea of numbers, this is what Gauss, and I think this is, you know, the way that at least part of a Riemannian, you know, conception of the world could be at least beginning to be approached, is by changing this notion of measurement. Now, if we change the notion of measurement, let's say from lengths to intervals of action, which is what I propose, what we do from now on with that is nothing but change. There's nothing that can be fixed. Nothing can be stable, can be assumed to be existing in an absolute state. Everything is in some way knowable only in the form of change, only in the form of transformation. And yet we are used to know things in the form of not changing. If that thing can stay there for, you know, half a minute, I can have a concept of it, right? That's the Aristotelian, you know, Cartesian, Newtonian trap, right
hold
there.
Hold still, damn it.
Right? Hold still so I can take a picture, right? And you take a cliché, right? That's another form, that's the visual form of torture, of stopping movement, stopping change, is to take a cliché, right? So you want to think a Riemannian manifold as something that will occur with crucial axiomatic changes. That is, changes that transform your conception of man and your conception of society. And that, the negentropy or non-entropy that LaRouche attributes to the idea of an Alcestis. Because if you change all the time, if in fact it is the case that, as Plato says, or Aristotle says, that nothing is permanent except change, right? And it's not a boutade, it's not, you know, a joke, it's very true that you have a situation where things axiomatically, unless they change, the entire society is going to collapse. And that's the crisis we're in after 500 years. Right? 500 years of embattlement between the oligarchy feuding with one another. And in between, you know, you have, you know, the nation state people. You know, Louis the 11th and Leibniz and Plato and so forth. But they're caught in between the feudal aristocracy and the financial aristocracy, and they have to break that to become the hegemonic renaissance. And that is the enlightenment that we have to break on the campuses, in our own minds, on the streets, everywhere. Right? That this is what we have to unravel, you know, at this point in history. And if we do that properly, we'll be able to have a future for mankind. So, I had some other material I wanted to go through, but I think it would be too extenuous to go into the general constructions of well, maybe I can give that this simple example, right? Just to illustrate. Look at what can be called a complex variable. This is an example that this guy Bell takes out of Gauss. But I suppose and I suspect that he throws a lot into it. But it's a useful example to make the point that I'm going to make about the necessitas of biquadratic residues. What he says is that we can identify this curve by an equal segment, which we'll call L, which is linear, perfectly linear. But this is non-linear. But he will attribute some function with this length L, which is going to call function z. All right, let's say these are the divisions. And you're going to have P sub 1, well, let's start from the other way. P sub 4, P sub 3, P sub 2, P sub 1. P sub n, and the other way around, P sub n minus 1. Right. And somewhere in there, you're going to identify a function which is going to be called the z function, which is going to be look like something like this. And that if you are able to calculate and measure all z functions within the parameters of P to Pn, of P1 to P2, so you have lengths P1, P2, P2, P3, P3 to P4, and so forth. The idea would be to have the sum total of all of these in a series, and that would give you the function for that variable complex curve. Now, I'm not going to justify this. All of this is crap. Right? Because what is wrong with it is the mathematics of counting what is the actual lengths of intervals between one point and another. And if in order to change that, you do a analytical function, a analysis-situs function, rather than what this could be called an analysis or an analytical function. But let's say we are doing an analysis-situs function, that is a geometric function in the sense of Leibniz. Then you would have, in the form that I've shown before, that kind of construction. Right. And so on, and so forth. You would have a variable function that would have a directionality only as a whole, not in particular. That is, a directionality that would know exactly where to go, where to come back, and how to return on itself and find closure. It's not a blind function. it's very much directed, it's very much oriented in its process. It has finality. And think of, again, in the same way, musical composition functioning like that. That you have the one in your mind, you have the image in your mind of the totality, of the one that you want to achieve. And you develop, as you go along, the means, the discontinuities, the different modulations. Knowing what you're going to achieve will be a higher ordering totality. Now, if you do that with discoveries, if you do that with discoveries in music, if you do that with discoveries in physics, think of light, the light process that we in this class. How, you know, at the beginning with Romer, Romer raised the question, you know, to Huygens, right? Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could, in fact, have a conception that takes into account weight and light? See, he had already the conception. And no wonder he had a conception that led to the discovery that he made. The, you know, relativity of the propagation of light in space. But he had already understood the higher hypothesis that Bernoulli will discover more explicitly and will use to change, you know, the Cartesian and the Newtonian of his time. But that's the battle that we're in. No matter what we do, no matter what we use in terms of ideas and discoveries, we have to orient our forces, like Carnot. Like Carnot, and I would say like Poncelet, of the École Polytechnique. We have to revive that principle of the École Polytechnique, the principle of Poncelet, where he says that what is crucial is that in a very short period of time, you can educate ordinary labor, ordinary individuals, students, into discovering a principle that is underlying the field of activity that he has chosen, whether it's gardening, or whether it's engineering, or whether it's architecture, right? Or music. And then secondly, that student should be made to discover the underlying process that is determining what is common between his skills and the skill of someone else. For example, what is common between music and geometry. He uses the example of how for thousands of years the ellipse was understood in a certain way by a gardener, was understood in a different way, but then you look at the entirety of the heavens, and you say, how can you have a God in the universe that proceeds, that has the procession of all of these wonderful planets and wonderful stars in elliptical forms, or quasi-elliptical forms? And once you do that, thirdly, you want to bring to the students the ability to discover the fundamental theorem that brings all of the underlying principles into a common manifold. All of the human activities have an underlying principle that is common to all of their activities. And that can be taught. And the only way that it can be taught is, in fact, with this kind of Riemannian manifold of increasing cardinality, as Lin would say, using the word of Cantor, right? That is, increasing negentropically the ability of mankind to have power over the universe. That's the issue. The issue is increase mankind's power over the universe. And yes, the universe will obey. Look at, simply, I'm just going to end with this, how Gauss was looking at biquadratic residues at the same time that he was looking at also astronomy. And it's not strange that he would have a conception of the rotation of the Earth and the Moon relative to the Sun in something of that nature. Because if you simply think of the Moon rotating around the Earth, all you see is an ellipse, or a circle. Or if you think of the Earth going around the Sun, all you see in your mind is an ellipse or a circle. But when you look at the actual pathway, the interval of action, not the thing, but the interval of action in between the Sun and the Earth and the Moon, you can see that you're having a complex function, right? Which determines, in fact, you can imagine that this whole process, this is what Bostick and others were looking at in terms of the infinitely small. That's what Riemann was beginning to address with that his dissertation, but he said in the large, you can't see the interval, right? You can only see the storms. But in the infinitely small, you have to address the infinitely small with a method which will resemble something like this. Some of you may remember some of the work that Bostick did. Took that out of Bostick. Here's the L-chime electron that Bostick was working on. Right? The same kind of principle. The problem with Bostick is that he went into all of the mathematics of Euler and Lagrange and so forth, and would not agree with Lin when Lin was addressing the change in his metric. And the problem is that he was not able to come up with the actual solution to the kinds of problems that require a Riemannian manifold. So this is the electron as viewed by Bostick, which is, the analysis theta's characterization, at least in terms of the movement and the change, is there. The behavior, in motion of an electron. So you end up solving, if you solve that kind of problem, you solve the problem of the astrophysics and microphysics today. Now what you find today is the wall, that was brought up by Heisenberg and the others, where they're, they bring their uncertainty principle to bear on physics, right? So that means you got to go back to Planck. You got to go back to Weber, you got to go back to Gauss, and so forth. Leonardo da Vinci, Kepler, because the principles are there. The problem is that you have no life anymore in these ideas. We've come to the period of a dead universe. And we're the only ones who can bring life to it. So that's basically what I wanted to go through. If people want to see the full potential implications of this kind of geometry of analysis, Cetus, in terms of physics, here's the configuration of a plasma machine in which you can see basically two types of magnets, the magnet that is going around like this, two magnetic fields here. These magnets are called the toroidal magnets, and that's the magnets that are the small diameter of the torus, and the large diameter or the large periphery of the torus is the toroidal, poloidal field magnet. And this gives you a general view of the magnetic field geometry, where you can identify the poloidal field, which is the short configuration of circular action when we're going like this. And this configuration here, which is the toroidal action, and both of those will create a helical field where the particles, the ionized particles, are going to be essentially along the lines, are going to form themselves and generate themselves along the lines of these two magnetic fields. And the kind of analysis cetus needed for this are exactly the kind of prime number treatment that Riemann and Gauss are talking about. So I will just end with that and open for questions.
Actually demonstrate what you just said on fields by taking a piece of white paper and putting a flat magnet underneath it and iron filings and shaking it, because those fields immediately identify themselves and form a little stripe looking things.
Yeah, you could do that with little pieces of steel.
Iron filings.
I have one question, but in terms of what you were reading from Timaeus, it's also, which fits in with what Riemann was doing, is a section there, I think it's around the discussion around the midwife for human objects, is we actually said that space is a co-determinant or co-factor in the existence of the object itself. So not only is it not a vacuum.
And he calls that the cora. Yeah, the cora.
A nice concept that space would actually be involved in the formation itself.
Yeah. It's a nurse. He calls it the nurse.
One question I have for you is, Linnan has referred a couple of times now, but in his time reversal paper, he made some, I think if I got it right, he talked about the difference between Euclidean and non-Euclidean, and then he talked about and then he talked about that this is where the quasi-Pythagorean comes, he calls it quasi, I think. And he gives his little formula. Why is he sticking that in there? Is that because the Pythagorean theorem would be for Euclidean only universe, right?
I'm not sure. I think that, there's a whole current of mathematics around Lobachevsky that is not Gaussian. And they're dealing with surfaces of negative curvature and so forth, and they have all these tricks. Of trying to establish the actual proof that it's not a Euclidean manifold that they're dealing with, because you don't have parallels, the parallel will cross, the parallels will you know, jump over one another, will meet, and so forth. All this nonsense about parallel lines is totally Euclidean in character.
Right.
It's a Euclidean way of thinking.
But
so you don't need that, right?
But that's what I was trying to...
So why is Lynn referencing this Pythagorean in that way? Is he trying to make some distinction? Is he still trying to hold on to Euclidean? Or that he's saying that the Pythagorean is still remains in the Euclidean universe, which he's neo-Euclidean by Lomachevsky and others?
I don't know. I couldn't answer that.
But he made a big point of the controversial paper.
Yeah.
So I quote my intention.
Can I say, that's what I was trying to say, my question earlier, about constant curvature? Because you can have a constantly negative curvature where the triangles that you have in there proceed along, depending, I mean, in other words, you have a principle for those triangles that progresses. It is constantly curved. Okay, on a positive surface, what you've done is the postulate has been changed. In other words, on a positively curved surface, like a sphere, what you do is you take one postulate, parallel lines meet at the North Pole.
Right.
The meridians. Yeah. Right. Okay, so that's just one postulate. It's still constantly curved surface. It's not what Riemann is talking about in the thing that he says in his paper, that you can have translations in a surface that is not constantly curved. In other words, even on a positive surface or a negative surface, you can translate on that. And it'll still maintain, the displacement will be the same no matter where you are. Yeah. And those are neo-Euclidean. In other words, you still have a quasi-Pythagorean. It's not the two right angles, but there still is, because there's a constant change, the change is the same everywhere.
Okay, so maybe.
Yeah. But what he's saying in the third part is that you can't say that that's what physical reality is, because you can move from a curvature which was positive to negative and so forth, but it's not based on some arbitrary change of postulate, it's actually based upon the physical measurement of the physical reality itself. And that's what he says at the end of the paper, we have to go outside these questions, measurements of physics.
This is the point Riemann makes at the end, and also Lynn keeps making again and again, is that you change the measurement. The measurement becomes the analysis itself of discontinuity. That is, you're not dealing with some continuous function within a manifold, and the ordering within the manifold itself, which is going to be continuous no matter which manifold you take. I don't care if it's positive curvature, negative curvature, it doesn't matter. The point is that the discoveries that form the higher manifold, that is, the discovery manifold, the manifold that is constructed by a whole series of discoveries that are all discontinuous vis-a-vis one another. Right? They have no relationship to one another, except through a higher ordering principle. That's what Lynn addresses as the actual series of discontinuities, the density of discontinuities. Right? That form the true mapping of the human mind. That is, it's made up of changes, shock waves, different types of shock waves, different type of events that change axiomatically everything that you knew before. And that this is the kind of continuity that you have in space-time, and forms the curvature of physical space-time, which is made up of holes, of discontinuities. Right? And that's the essence of it. Sometimes, you can find yourself thinking linearly again, saying, well, the entire universe is continuous. But within that continuous universe, you have holes. You have discontinuity, but it's continuous. But in that continuing universe, you know, I'm going to make some bumps, right? I'm going to create some bumps. That's not what's going on. You still have, when you do that, you still have, you know, the Euclidean continuum, and you're considering discontinuities as being interruptions within continuity. It's the opposite. It's continuity that brings discontinuities within discontinuities. It's the reverse. Right? And the only way to do that, the only way to see that, is through the paradoxes. Right? You have to bring the system to the limit. Bring any axiomatic system to the limit, and it's going to break down. It's going to be risky. It's going to be scary. Especially if these ideas that you're dealing with have to do with saving mankind. They're very scary. Huh? Remember Fermat. Right? Because this, think of this in the back of your mind. What did Fermat do? Fermat gave up his soul. He confessed to a crime that he had not committed. Now, if you confess to a crime you have not committed, you have lost your soul. And that's what happens to Fermat. And he will not fight after that. He'll be afraid of ideas. He'll be scared of ideas. He'll say, well, what if, you know? And the Cartesians are there like, you know, little monsters. I mean, you gotta imagine, you know, there's a whole crowd of them all over Paris, right? They're monsters, right? They're like, you know, the Todd police. They watch, right? They keep a watch. You know, who's talking about least action here? You know, what did I hear? Action, what did you say? Everything has to be fixed and instantaneous, right? Yet, light is the first fundamental finite or transcendental phenomenon that is akin to the human thinking, to human creativity. And Fermat saw that. He knew that. He discovered that. And he was made to confess to a crime that he had not committed. Huh? So that's what we have to, again, fight for. This is what the Carnot principle that Lee Linz keeps, you know, going at again and again and again. It's not, the Carnot principle, it's not simply, you know, the flank. Create a new flank. Yes, you got to create flanks, you got to create appropriate flanks. But the real principle of Carnot is attack, 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 all the time. Keep attacking. Unless you attack the enemy within, the enemy without, you are not going to be able to be a creative human being. You're not going to be able to see clearly what the actual final objective imperative is. So it applies, you know, in all of what we do, you know, in terms of ideas as well as in terms of, you know, organizing and recruiting. So,
thank you.